Well, George, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. It is a great pleasure to be here tonight, although I often get a bit apprehensive addressing audiences outside the United Kingdom. Ever since I took a delegation of members of parliament to Japan a few years ago, and we had a banquet with the mayor of Hiroshima, can you believe? I had been to lay a wreath at the spot where the atomic bomb was dropped, as all the visitors to Hiroshima do. And then we sat down to a banquet with the mayor of Hiroshima, tables that were about this high, and we all sat cross-legged in increasing agony as the hours went by, and there was beautiful food on the table, and we ate the food, and I'd never been to Japan before, and the mayor kept saying through the interpreter how wonderful it was to have the British politicians there, and I kept saying through the interpreter how wonderful it was to have this wonderful banquet, and we ate this and we ate that of things I'd never seen before in my life, and wonderful things, every color and every type of food. And the interpreter kept going backwards and forwards between us, and eventually the interpreter started to look very concerned, but the mayor kept talking and I kept talking, and then there was a pause in the conversation, and the interpreter said in my ear, he said, "Ah, Mr. Haig, sir." I said, "Yes." He said, "You have now eaten the flower display." And indeed I had, and I had been munching steadily through all these crunchy things that I thought was elegant Japanese cooking. Really thinking, they do enjoy their natural food, don't they? And the mayor was looking across at me as if to say, however did they win the war? And we do have these, so I live in fear when I go, despite being the shadow foreign minister, I live in fear of cultural disasters abroad. When I was a minister, I once went to a European minister's meeting where all the conversation is through headphones and simultaneous translation. And there was a Danish minister speaking in French being translated into English by a Greek interpreter. And when he got to the part of his speech about the Maastricht Treaty and the Euro where he said, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," this was translated into English as, "The whiskey here is good, but the meat is awful." And all of the English... the English-speaking ministers all nodding, having completely dozed off, and were clearly not listening to what was going on. And one of the things that keeps me going in politics is the humorous side of politics. I love the unintended humor of politics. We have a very left-wing member of parliament, Dennis Skinner, in the House of Commons, who stood up about a year ago to ask the Minister for the Civil Service. He said, "How many of the people recruited to the civil service in the last year were A, men, or B, women?" And the minister answered, "All of them." And that completely took the wind out of his sails. I will never forget the day when I was a new member of parliament and Margaret Thatcher was still prime minister, and she listed her engagements for the day, and she said, "For the rest of the day, I have made myself available to Mr. Gorbachev." And the laughter rippled around the House of Commons. And none of us dared tell her afterwards what we had been laughing about, of course. Such was the terror that she exercised. And I love the repartee of the House of Commons. I wish you had it in Congress, actually. We have this quick-fire question time, the quick-fire repartee, often saying things that we regret. And the best, and often having to withdraw what we have just said. And Disraeli, one of the great conservatives of the 19th century, once said that half the cabinet are asses when he was attacking Gladstone's government. And the speaker intervened and said he cannot say that. And he said, "Well, I correct that then, Mr. Speaker. Half the cabinet are not asses," which was a particularly clever way of doing it. Now, I think one of our British contributions to liberty is irreverence, of which this is an example, and irreverence towards figures in authority, something that you don't find a great deal in, say, North Korea today, but you do find, thankfully, in Britain and in America. And that irreverence towards politicians was there in the time of the Pitts. I came across in my work on William Pitt the Younger a piece of hate mail from the early 19th century in the miscellaneous files that nobody had really looked in before. There was a letter from a disgruntled voter in 1805 which started, "I say, Billy." It said, "You infernal blackguardly son of a thief, you bottle-nosed rascal of a prime minister, Egad, my old buck. Now, no one ever puts egad in hate mail anymore. Egad, my old buck. You'll be getting alongside of the devil soon, he said, but he'll shave your timbers for you and give you a broadside and send you. But he won't send you to Windsor to drink 3 bottles of wine after dinner, while many a poor thing can't get bread, and all through you, you meagre-looking hound. So any idea that this was some genteel age in which a young man could succeed in politics because they were polite to each other, cast that aside. British politics at that time was at least as vituperative, at least as personal, perhaps more so than it is today. People would write even 200 years ago in that style to their politicians. Sometimes the politicians wrote back in a similar vein, knowing that they did not have that many voters and were not that dependent on them. And I came across in the 1820s, slightly later, a letter written by a British Member of Parliament to voters who had written to him about the increase in indirect taxes, the increase in duties that we call excise duties. And he wrote back in a manner I do not recommend to any congressman running for re-election this November. He wrote, "You have written to me with your opinions concerning the excise." And he said, "I am surprised at your insolence in doing so." He said, "I remind you of what you ought to know, that I bought your votes at the last election." And he said, this is true, this is a true letter. And he's only warming up at this point. "And I know," he said, "what you think I do not know, that you are now planning to sell them to another candidate. Well," he said, "I know what you certainly do not know, that I have already purchased another seat." So he finished off with both barrels. He said, "May God confound your wretched views upon the excise, and may your homes ever be as open and free to the exciseman as your wives and daughters have always been to me while I have sat for your constituents." Now, that is the ultimate valedictory letter from a politician. Now, there is no record of the reply of William Pitt to the letter I quoted from earlier, and indeed there was probably no reply because he, William Pitt the Younger, was utterly hopeless at his correspondence. He was a paradoxical figure in many ways. He is known to history as a Tory, but he never would have called himself a Tory. He regarded himself as an independent figure of merit who was above considerations of party politics. He was described by Wilberforce as the wittiest man he ever knew, and yet he thought he was the shyest man alive, and most people found him so. He was brilliant at handling the nation's finances, being the Chancellor of the Exchequer and Prime Minister for 19 years. At that time, the job was combined, which at least avoided damaging splits between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, as Tony Blair and Gordon Brown might now reflect. But he mismanaged his own personal finances to the tune of being £2 million in today's money, or $3.5 million in debt personally when he died. He was an eternal optimist about people and events, particularly in wartime, and yet he worked and worried and drank himself to death, and he was a highly efficient administrator in many ways, and yet on his desk when he died in 1806, there were allegedly letters unopened from the 1780s that had been over 20 years littering his desk with nobody bothering to open them. The irreverence towards him is part of our contribution to liberty, and it was an irreverence even to the royal family of the time. British caricatures were ruder about the royal family then than they are now. And Prince George, Prince of Wales, was more unpopular than any member of the royal family in more recent times. He also put on public display true scandals, truly catastrophic scandals. His marriage to Princess Caroline of Brunswick so disappointed him that he sent his mistress to greet her at the docks. He asked for brandy as soon as he saw her. He was drunk throughout the wedding ceremony. When he was crowned king in Westminster Abbey in 1820, he had her locked out of Westminster Abbey during the ceremony in which she should have been crowned queen. And when in 1821 Napoleon died and the messengers came to him, now George IV, to tell him and said, "Your Majesty, your greatest enemy is dead," he apparently replied, "By God, is she?" and thought they were thought they were talking about his wife. There were political scandals too at the time. The main scandal involving William Pitt was that he drank so much. 3 bottles of port a day was his regular, meant to be his regular consumption. There were often little rhymes in opposition newspapers like the Morning Chronicle. When he staggered into the Commons in 1793 with his lieutenant, Henry Dundas, the little rhyme said, "I cannot see the speaker, Hal, can you? What, cannot see the speaker? I see two." And he was, much fun was made of him on that basis. But drink, of course, played a huge role in British elections at the time. There was a technique known as birking in elections, which was to lock your opponent's voters in the tavern with so much to drink that they were not able to get out until the voting was over. There was a technique known as shopping, which was to give your opponent's voters so much to drink that they died before they got to the polling station. This was successfully carried out with decisive effect in the city of Gloucester in 1761. The amount of drink of alcohol disbursed in elections in 1780, in the 1784 election, one of the candidates in the city of Chester provided 1,000 barrels of ale, 4,000 casks of rum, and 27,000 bottles of wine for an election that involved 1,500 voters. That is the scale. The sheer scale of what was going on. And one of the wonderful things about British politics at that time is that it was this patchwork of different electoral systems. Some constituencies where no people lived at all because the boundaries had not been moved for hundreds of years. And whoever owned the property in that constituency determined who were the 2 members of Parliament. Pitt himself, William Pitt the Younger himself, was appointed to a rotten borough, one of those places. He wrote with delight to his mother when he was 21 years old, "Appleby is the place I am to represent. I am to be elected without having any difficulty or even having to visit my constituents." And a very different situation from what we have to do today. Where there were voters, those voters had to be indulged on a massive scale. And it was all the more expensive because the voting could go on for weeks until the returning officer thought everyone who needed to vote or wanted to vote had voted. 40 days of voting in the city of Westminster in 1784. 15 days was common. In Yorkshire, my county, which held a contested election in 1807 when William Wilberforce was one of the candidates, there was only 1 polling station in York in the entire county. People took a week to come on wagons, horses, barges, coming across the county in order to vote. All taverns had to be secured for them to stay at, dinners provided for them for days before they could vote. Riots broke out in the meantime. The candidates each spent £100,000, $5 million in today's money, on an election that involved 20,000 voters. And it is testimony to the tradition British people have given Americans of hugely expensive elections that such money was involved for such a small electorate. But it's testimony to the obstinate independence of the British voter that the candidate who spent by far the least in that election came top of the poll, despite the huge expenditure. So we see in late 18th century and early 19th century British politics this happy conjunction of no-holds-barred elections combined with what we would regard as great scandal. The affray I describe in my book when Pitt was in the election of 1784, when Pitt's carriage in St. James's Street in London was set about by his opponents, who literally tore and battered it to pieces. The gentleman of Brooks's club came out and battered it to pieces in the street. He had to be hauled to the safety of White. And the alibi with which his opponent, Charles James Fox, demonstrated that he could not have been present at this affray was that he was in bed with his mistress at the time. And everybody thought that was a perfectly adequate excuse in the politics of the late 18th century. It's all part of the fascination of the politics of that time. And I often think that I really was meant to have been born in 1761, not 1961. Partly because it sounds great fun, the politics of that time, but partly because Parliament was in an age of eloquence, the British Parliament, at that time. That was because the votes in Parliament mattered. There were many independently minded members of Parliament. And so the speech that you made actually made a difference to the result, which is very different from most parliaments or congresses today. And that brought out the best in the speakers of the time. It really mattered. Now, today history is largely studied in little packets. I was taught British history at school from 1815 to 1914, which meant that you knew every single thing that could possibly have happened in 1814 and nothing that had 1815 and nothing at all that had happened in 1814, without which, of course, you could not really understand anything that happened in 1815. I don't know what it's like in America, but the way British history is now taught in our schools, you learn about the Tudors and the Nazis, and you have no knowledge of the intervening 350 years at all. Everything in between is a black hole. You learn about the French Revolution, but have no idea what impact it made on other countries at all. And I was one of the people who didn't really have much idea about these things until I gave an infamous speech when I was a teenager at the Conservative Party conference, and Margaret Thatcher took me to one side afterwards, and she said, "We may be standing here with another young Mr. Pitt." And I thought, what is she talking about? Because I hadn't studied Mr. Pitt at all in my inadequate history syllabus. But eventually I went on to learn about Mr. Pitt and indeed to write a book about Mr. Pitt. And In doing so, I went to look at the grave of William Pitt in Westminster Abbey. It's a rare grave. It is the grave of two British prime ministers, Pitt the elder and Pitt the younger, buried in the same tomb. It is, of course, highly unusual for us in Britain to have a father and son prime minister. You are more familiar with this concept in the United States. And we often observe how strange it is that all those people who left Europe to get away from titles and hereditary descent are probably now approaching your sixth consecutive presidential election in which one of the candidates will be called either Bush or Clinton. But there we are. That is a matter of choice for you. But there in that grave, with the inscription worn smooth by the passage of so many feet over it, a neglected grave, lies a man, Pitt the Younger, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer when he was 23 years old, Prime Minister when he was 24 years old, who was laughed at the time for being a schoolboy as Prime Minister, but who went on to be Prime Minister for 19 of the subsequent 22 years, who, even when he died in office at the age of 46, was still younger than all but two of his 37 successors, even when they entered office as Prime Minister, who lived in 10 Downing Street for longer than any other politician before or since, who was the longest-serving war leader of the United Kingdom, who debated in an age of eloquence in the House of Commons with Fox and Burke and Sheridan and Wilberforce and was the equal or master of them all, who saw off attempted invasions of Britain, dealt with rebellion in Ireland, ended a run on the Bank of England, plotted naval strategy with Nelson, and stood alone against Napoleon. And so this is a towering figure in the history of the English-speaking people. And William Pitt the Younger is a person we need to know, everyone needs to know more about. That is why I wrote a book about him. He was able to become a prime minister at the age of 24, partly because of the American Revolution, the American War of Independence, which handily destroyed an entire generation of British politicians. A wonderfully convenient thing for a young man on the make. And also because politics was a younger man's game at that time, and also because he was a brilliant operator. He created an image of himself, one of the first politicians to do so, of honest Billy. In an age of thieving, venal, corrupt politicians, he stood above it all as honest Billy. And he really got the idea of that from his father, William Pitt the Elder, after whom this great city is named. And I was reflecting, arriving here this afternoon, how astonished he would be now to see this enormous city, and how even more astonished he would be to learn that it had won something called a Super Bowl. And probably William Pitt the Younger would be wanting to drink out of the Super Bowl. This would be utterly bewildering to them. But William Pitt the Younger was a rare instance of a prime minister who was literally tutored at the knee of another one, a head of an administration who was taught to be a prime minister by his father when he was 7 or 8 years old, who arrived in the House of Commons ready-made as an orator and politician, so that Edmund Burke would exclaim when he heard Pitt the Younger, "This is not a chip off the old block, this is the block itself." And that was the impression he made. He had not gone to school, but he had attended a master class in government and oratory and parliament, and was always aware that he was the son of this great man, Pitt the Elder, the Churchill of his day. Like Churchill, a difficult, voluble, unpredictable, temperamental in some ways politician, but who stepped forward at the time of a great war, in this case the Seven Years' War, as it has come to be known, in which he adopted the strategy of, rather than sending British armies to fight on the continent, of stripping the French of their entire empire, which even 250 years later is an idea that warms the heart of every Englishman. And it was Pitt the Elder who presided over the great year of victories in 1759, with the British armies storming the heights at Quebec, and victory for our allies at Minden on the continent and on the high seas at Quiberon Bay. And Walpole wrote that our church bells are worn threadbare with their ringing as the news of the victories poured in from India as well. And that was his first great contribution to American liberty. He made the American Revolution possible, in a sense, by removing one of the external threats, the French presence in Canada. And his second contribution, perhaps, was his approach to politics, which was to rise above all that corruption of the time. It was very common for people responsible for the public treasury, for instance, to pay the money into their private bank accounts and profit from all the interest. In the meantime, Henry Fox made a vast fortune doing so in the 1750s. He disdained all that and disdained the titles that politicians craved. He was the great commoner, and elevated the idea of public service rather than personal aggrandizement. Now, he was diverted from that in some ways. He ended up taking the title of Earl of Chatham, and Thomas Gray said never was so weak a thing. Failing the country in his final time as Prime Minister. But he remained very far-sighted about the American colonies. He denounced the Stamp Act. He went back to Parliament to deliver thundering denunciations of the Stamp Act. Taxes, he said, could be legally imposed only on those whom the imposers represented. The Commons of Great Britain were no representatives of the people of America, ergo could impose no tax on them. And he then said, according to the reports, many kind and affectionate things of America. And he gave great harangues on the £2 or 3 million she annually paid us, and how pitiful it was to lose that sum for a paltry £50,000 or £60,000 per annum. He warned of the folly of war with America. He told Parliament they should make concessions while they could, not when they must do so. And so the younger Pitt inherited that tradition and was one of the persecutors of Lord North's government and one of those who threw it out of office in 1782 after Yorktown. And so these things, I think, are part of the common, making Britain and America the common homes of liberty. The elder Pitt saw them as the common homes of liberty, and the real enemy being Bourbon tyranny on the continent of Europe. Now, this still matters enormously, this connection with America, to British politicians today. You can see it in every British Prime Minister of recent times. You will see it in whoever is the next British Prime Minister. To many of us, as there was to them, there is a huge personal connection. There is to me. My parents have visited every state of the Union. My sister is a naturalized American citizen in New Jersey. I take a holiday every year in Montana. I've been to nearly 40 states of the Union. America is my second home. And so that cultural connection, that kinship across the Atlantic, which Pitt the Elder had tried to defend, is alive and well 250 years later. And it meant, of course, that there was a body of opinion in Britain that was against war with America, that was for sensible reform of British institutions, that was skeptical of aristocratic power in Britain, and was for the modernized organization of government within the conservative part of the body politic in Britain. Such notions were not left to radicals and revolutionaries. And this is the most important respect in which the younger Pitt was his father's son, in idealizing his father and taking up this tradition. The teenage younger Pitt added to these instincts the thinking of Adam Smith and of Locke and of William Paley. And he combined in his person the ideas of freer trade and fiscal responsibility and a simpler tax system and peace with America and the reform of the British state to make it more efficient and representative and the defense of freedom under the rule of law. All combined together and implemented in a spirit of evolutionary change, just as revolutionary change became the great contagion of Britain's most powerful neighbor, France, at the time. And this, I think, is a very important contribution. It's also crucial that these were the men who led the fight to abolish the slave trade, standing out amongst the attitudes of the 1770s generation, the younger Pitt, William Wilberforce, the people who were teenagers in the 1770s, was their attitude to slavery and the slave trade. And they had picked up not only a moral objection to slavery, but the arguments of Adam Smith, the economic denunciation of slavery. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, saying the experience of all ages and nations demonstrates that the work done by slaves is in the end the dearest of any, since a person who can acquire no property can have no other interest but to eat as much and to labor as little as possible. Whatever work he does beyond what is sufficient to purchase his own maintenance can be squeezed out of him by violence only and not by any interest of his own. They combined, therefore, the moral and the economic case against slavery. It meant that the attack on the slave trade came in modern parlance, although these words were not used at the time, they came from the French Revolution, from the right as well as from the left. The ethical and economic theories were combined. And this is part of the inspiring story of William Wilberforce that I'm writing about at the moment, that when he realized the atrocities committed in the slave trade, so irremediable and so wicked did it appear, he said, that my mind was made up, let the consequences be what they would. I resolved from this time that I would never rest until I had effected its abolition, which took him 20 years of campaigning to do. And it should be a huge encouragement, I think, that these people were partly motivated and informed by true transatlantic cooperation and sharing of ideas. From Anthony Benezet, who came over from Philadelphia to fortify the British abolition movement. It should be a source of great pride, I think, that some of that thinking came here from Philadelphia, the Quakers of Philadelphia in 1754, denouncing the slave trade and saying that to live in ease and plenty by the toil of those who violence and cruelty have put in our power is incompatible with Christianity. And this language was taken up by the British abolitionists in a true spreading of transatlantic ideas. Now, William Pitt the Younger was later much criticized for restrictions on freedom of assembly and freedom of speech as he fought the French Revolution. Pitt's Terror, it was even called. He suspended habeas corpus at various times. But he thought that gradual change from within was right. Violent change and change from outside was unacceptable. And he held to this even as his life was consumed by the years of war with France. In 1805, he conferred with Nelson before the Battle of Trafalgar, as Nelson had his coffin made before he set out for the Battle of Trafalgar, had his coffin made in Piccadilly. And the sailors who set out with Nelson to that battle, even though they were not among those who had come to America to seek freedom in a promised land, to be away from all the kings and the wars and the taxes, and even though they were not as free to live their lives as those who had gone to America, still probably had some common notion of freedom and law in the English-speaking world, which their French and Spanish sailors they were about to fight could not have in their own countries. France had experienced violent revolution, as Edmund Burke warned, that when a separation is made between liberty and justice, neither could be safe. And that is what had happened in France at the time. The English sailors who set out to that battle knew that in their country the power of the monarch was limited, that ministers were held publicly to account, that judges could give rulings without fear, that taxes could not be levied without consent, that the violent elimination of political opponents was not part of the conduct of the government of their country. And they were therefore armed with such attachment to such notions, as well as being more experienced, better equipped, and better led, when they saw Nelson's signal that England expects that every man will do his duty. And they fought the Battle of Trafalgar on the 21st of October, 1805, and the news took about 16 days, even though it was only off the southwest coast of Spain, to reach the English coast. And the messenger, the couriers, then rode hard through the night from the south coast of England to London, arriving at 3 a.m. in Downing Street, where Pitt was woken with the dispatchers, and he tore them open, reading the news that Nelson was dead. But the dispatch from Admiral Collingwood, reporting the greatest and most decisive victory ever gained over a powerful enemy. 20 sail of the line captured. The French and Spanish navies, in effect, destroyed. And in 1 week of history, in November, early November 1805, you can see illuminated that whole period of war. Only 4 days earlier had come the news of another Napoleonic victory on the continent at the Battle of the Ulm, which had put the British into great despondency. Now, the news of Trafalgar meant London rose in a tumult of rejoicing, and Pitt was hauled along to the Lord Mayor's banquet in the City of London on the Saturday afternoon, the 9th of November, and toasted as the saviour of England and of Europe. And he returned thanks for it in the simplest, shortest, and most memorable speech ever given by a British Prime Minister. England, he said, is not to be saved by any single man. England has saved herself by her exertions, and will, I trust, save Europe by her example. And it was the last time his voice was ever heard in public. His health was collapsing. He went to the waters of Bath to try to recover it. There heard the terrible news of the Battle of Austerlitz, French domination of the continent, guaranteed for the foreseeable future. And so it was in January 1806, of the bicentenary of 1806, that we commemorate this year in 2006, that he was taken back to his home near London, dying of the ulcers on his in his digestive system, trying to get back to the Houses of Parliament to carry on government, utterly dedicated to public service, saying that he would rather die at his post than quit it. By the 22nd of January, he was dying and asked to pray with his friend Bishop Pretterman. He said, very candidly, he had neglected prayer for too long to have any hope it would be efficacious now. His mind wandered in delirium as he lay dying, still conscious of his public duty, inquiring of the direction of the wind to bring a messenger from Berlin, hoping for a new alliance with the Prussians, and saying, ah, east, that will bring him quick. Now and again saying, hear, hear, as if sitting in the House of Commons. The little boy who only wanted to serve in the House of Commons like Papa when he was 7 years old was still thinking about it in his final hours. And his final words, Pitt the Younger, were either, according to who you believe, my country, how I love my country, or my country, how I leave my country, or bring me one of Bellamy's pork pies. Now, given the state of his digestion, it seems highly unlikely it was the latter. It was wholly in character for him to say, how I leave my country, because he had utterly devoted himself to his country's service with a wonderful combination of a sense of public duty, of national independence, of fiscal responsibility, and of liberty under a rule of law. And today, I think, 200 years later, as we can see around us now, this wonderful and prosperous city, named after one of the Pitts, the Elder Pitt, I think those things that they can be said to have stood for, of public duty and national independence and fiscal responsibility and liberty under the law, are also great values that today still shine on. Thank you very much indeed.